Welcome to a special bonus episode of School of Practice on Edutopia Radio. I'm Kristen Leong, and this week we're doing something a little bit different. Every December, our research team curates a list of the 10 most significant education studies published in the last year. It's a tradition that goes back a decade and involves wrestling with hundreds of studies to identify an all-star lineup of 10 that we think every teacher should know about. Today, the authors, our research editor, Yuki Terada, and editor-in-chief, Stephen Merrill, are here to unpack the details of four of the most compelling studies that made this year's list. Plus, we'll end with a lightning round, where we'll cover three bonus studies. We'll tell you what you need to know to put this research to work in your classroom, and we'll share some cool details that didn't make it into our article. Okay, let's get into it. Before we jump into the meaty details of these studies, I want to understand how you curate this list. First of all, how many studies do you each read in a year? Steve, start us off.
I'd say I probably read on the order of a couple of 100 studies a year myself, and I read them at different levels. Some I read very, very deeply. I read them multiple times because I'm going to write about them. Other times I may skim or go to one or two sections and focus on those, like an abstract or a discussion where I'm trying to find out, well, you know, what's the gist of this study?
Mm-hmm. Yuki, what about you?
Yeah, it's hundreds. I mean, to crunch the numbers, every 2 weeks I bring between 10 and 12 studies for the group to read. So at minimum, as a group, we're reading 240 studies a year. But beyond that, you know, for every study that I pitch, there's probably five that I read that I don't pitch. And there's probably 10 to 20 that I scan that I don't read fully. And so my background, my actual training is in research. I was a researcher before Edutopia. So I know all about study design. So I'm really comfortable digging into the nuts and bolts of a study, figuring out, okay, what's the study trying to say?
Steve, can you dig in there a little bit more? Can you say more about, of all of the hundreds of studies that you and Yuki are looking at, what are specifically the factors that determine whether a study is included or not?
Yeah, I would say some of it is probably Yuki could talk to a little bit better, but I would say, you know, the quality of the study itself. We're looking for randomized controlled studies. We're looking for the gold standard of studies. And we're also looking for studies that we think teachers actually want to hear about. We're looking for studies where we can actually say, okay, so the way to use this tomorrow is this way. And that does play a very big role in whether something lands on the list or not. I should say, though, that we very rarely go after the sensational study. We're not looking for the study that says, hey, wine is good 1 year and then wine is bad the next year. Mm. We're trying to find themes and we're trying to base things in cognitive theory and make sure that it's scaffolded by other studies. So we're actually looking for studies that say something new, but they're based in older research. Mm. So there's a lot of history behind them.
Great. Let's dive into the research, starting with breaks. Steve, this year you covered a study that had a lot to say about how long students can focus. What's the takeaway there?
People don't stay focused for very long. And that's the point of the research. You cannot entertain your way to attention in your classroom. Teachers say this, we believe it, this study proves it. Ultimately, attention wanes. And any act of learning involves attentional declines over time. Like if you look at the history of the experimental studies on this topic, researchers place the limits of sustained attention at various thresholds, 8 minutes, 10 minutes, maybe 25 minutes, depending on the nature of the lecture, the age of the students, the quality of the material. In any case, it's somewhere less than 30 minutes and probably considerably less than 30 minutes.
Especially for our younger students, probably.
For our youngest students, it could be as short as a couple minutes. In the study that we covered, these were, I believe, again, college-age students. Is that right, Yuki? I believe they were college-age students.
Yeah.
And the first point where they sensed wobbly focus was about 5 minutes into the lecture. And it steadily declined for the rest of the lecture in both experimental groups. The group that got frequent micro breaks experienced attentional declines. And the group that received only one break saw vastly larger attentional declines. At the end of the day, the thing you have to be aware of is that 5 or 6 minutes in, regardless of how entertaining you've been, how compelling you've been, you're going to start to lose some focus. The kids are going to start fading out. Our brains naturally cycle through periods of high attention and then low attention. You know, it's like the recovery after a workout.
Now, earlier, Steve, you touched on this idea of micro breaks to help students reset. What's a micro break and what can you tell us about that 2025 study?
Right, this is a great study. So a micro break was a 90-second break every 10 minutes during a 90-minute lecture. And in that 90 seconds, kids weren't doing much. Kids were closing their eyes, they were drinking water, they were chatting with each other. The other group of kids who attended the same 90-minute lecture had only one 10-minute break at the 45-minute point. So halfway through, they got a break, a 10-minute break. The other kids got breaks of 90 seconds every 10 minutes. And those kids who got 90-second breaks were able to maintain their focus much more effectively and performed much better on a follow-up quiz, up to 76% better, in fact. So very, very simple strategy. It worked very, very well.
So consistent short breaks are going to be more impactful than one big break in the middle of your class.
Yes, because I think it's more consistent with what the researchers called our neural architecture, is the way they put it, right? Which is, you've got 10 minutes, maybe 15 minutes. So according to these researchers, instead of trying to overcome attentional limits, it's probably better to work within them, you know, breaking your lessons down into smaller units that are more digestible for students. Kids can consume it and then stop. I don't think you have to do it every 10 minutes, by the way. I don't think there's a magic to that number. It's just that you really have to think in terms of short segments.
Now, Yuki and Steve, should the types of breaks you use vary if you're teaching older students versus younger kids? Like maybe a group of second graders needs a little more movement in their break, whereas high school students could just sit at their desk and close their eyes.
Yeah, I mean, you don't have to adhere to any certain type of break. So a wide range of breaks works. Whatever you think works for your classroom. You can even have academic breaks. So what's very helpful, we've seen in past studies, is if you are covering really dense material, then you take a short break after 5 or 10 minutes to let kids go through their notes, review their notes, and maybe shore up their thinking. Maybe try to think about, okay, what are the big ideas, and jot down, okay, what are the three main things I need to be taking away from the past 5 minutes that I've just listened to?
Right. And I think it's, you know, I know it's a radical proposition, Kristen, but we kind of trust teachers right here. So use the breaks that you think your kids need. Yuki's really talking there about shifting modalities as well. So not everything has to be a break. You can go from direct instruction to group work. You can take a quiz together. There's lots of things you can do to change modalities. That works as well. But I would say, and I would kind of, I hate to be insistent, but I do think sometimes a break, a literal brain break, where you are not doing any academic work, is highly beneficial.
So know your students and give them frequent breaks.
Yes, that's right.
Okay, let's move on. Our second study looked at the strategies students use to successfully solve math word problems. Yuki, what's happening in students' brains when they read a story problem and try to solve it? Working memory is key here, right?
Absolutely. So when students read a word problem, their brains are trying to do two different things at the same time. So first, they're trying to decode the story. They're trying to understand, you know, what's happening, who is doing what, how everything ties together. And they're also trying to understand the underlying math that's in the word problem. They're trying to translate between the story elements and the mathematical elements within the word problem. And all of that creates a significant load on working memory.
Yuki, tell us a little more about the study in question. What grade levels are we talking about here? What are the researchers looking at? And what were some big picture conclusions?
So the researchers were looking at math word problems in middle school that were related to real world scenarios. So for example, calculating the cost of gas, food, and lodging for a family road trip. And they found that these types of problems can exert high demands on working memory. So for example, if I ask you to remember a phone number, that's information that you're holding in short-term memory. Working memory is when you're trying to manipulate that information. So if I ask you not to necessarily remember a phone number, but to reorder the numbers from smallest to greatest, now you're actually taking each individual digit and you're manipulating it.
And Yuki, what did the researchers find in terms of strategies that didn't work well for these middle school math students? And what approaches moved kids from struggling to capable?
So what didn't work was simply trying to highlight all the key details in a word problem. The students that only highlighted information didn't do as well as the student who used that as a first step to reorganizing and restructuring the information. So the kids who did the best, they sketched diagrams. They broke the information down into different categories and they annotated the problem with arrows and labels. So the kids who did the best engaged in a form of cognitive offloading, where they used the scratch paper to zoom in on the problem, isolate the parts that they needed to focus on, solve that particular piece of the problem, and then set it aside and went on to different parts of the problem.
Now, Yuki, how do the researchers know that these strategies work?
Well, since the students were writing out notes, they can actually see the thinking. The students who wrote things out and deconstructed the problems, they performed 29% better than the students who only highlighted the different details of a word problem.
This was an interesting study because it was roughly 1,000 math word problems solved by middle schoolers that they were looking at. So they could really see how the middle schoolers were attacking these problems, where they were stumbling, and what the most capable students were figuring out, how they were getting to the right answers. They could see it at scale.
And it's such a beautiful insight into how students' brains work while they're trying to solve problems, which, you know, really applies to many different types of problems. This isn't a strategy that's limited to solving math word problems. It could apply to history if you're, you know, trying to have a debate. These are strategies that help students understand how to deconstruct a very, very complex problem, how to break it down into manageable chunks, and then tackle them individually instead of trying to figure out how to solve the entire thing in one go.
We've got to take a quick micro break. When we come back, we'll learn what happens when cell phones exit classrooms. And get ready for our lightning round. We will cover 3 bonus studies in 3 minutes. Okay, be right back.
Hi, it's Yuki from the Edutopia team. Want to keep up with what the research says about how students learn best? Check out The Research Is In. It's a monthly email newsletter curated by the Edutopia editors, and it's packed with practical insights that are ready to be put into use in your classroom or school community. And yep, like everything from Edutopia, it's totally free and always will be. Ready to sign up? Head to edutopia.org/the research is in.
Okay, we have talked about breaks and math. Let's move on to cell phones. Yuki, there was a study of college-age students out of India that caught your eye. Why did you include it?
This was a very big study. It was 17,000 college students. And typically when you see research on cell phone bans, it's usually not that large. And they're usually observational, which means a school or a district implements a phone ban, and then researchers look at what happens to students after the ban has been implemented. But what was interesting about this study was not only was it so large, but it was a randomized controlled trial. So it was an experimental study where you had very clean group of students who were in the control group who had business as usual conditions, which was they can have their cell phones or not, whatever their choice was, versus students who were in classrooms that banned phones. Because there were so many students and because they were randomly assigned to one of these two conditions, you can very cleanly see the impact of the ban itself.
Now, Steve, you have read a ton about cell phones in the past. Before we talk about what happens when cell phones leave schools, let's quickly revisit what happens when they are in classrooms.
Yeah, I think there were 3 big myths that kept cell phones in classrooms. The first was this idea that they were these incredibly powerful microcomputers, and we'd bring them into classrooms and you'd load them up with applications and, you know, video applications and audio applications and Kahoot and quizzing tools. And kids would learn more effectively. There was even an equity issue here where we thought, well, because these are affordable and so many kids have them, this is a way to get to equity in terms of technology access. What actually happened is that they were kind of little dopamine bricks. Kids were bringing them into classrooms and they were pretty much feasting on an indiscriminate diet of media. According to research I reviewed, kids were texting, they were watching feature movies, they were shopping in class. The idea that teachers could keep up with that, I mean, forget it. You stand no chance. And so that was number one. You know, that was an early myth, and I think teachers caught on to it relatively quickly. The second myth was that schools were going to be able to teach kids to exert self-control over their phones. So first, that's a lot of responsibility to lay at the feet of teachers. I also think the idea was naive, by the way. adults can't even control their cell phone usage. There's this study from the CDC I saw that showed that roughly 1/3 of adults admitted to writing or reading texts while driving their cars. But kids were going to learn to control usage in a classroom? It's just unrealistic. The last one is this idea that one child with a phone is one child distracted. And that's just not true. You've been a teacher, and I've been a teacher. Mm. If you have one kid reading on their phone and then two kids reading on their phone, suddenly everyone wants to read on their phone.
It's contagious. So,
yeah, it's contagious. And we know this about other behaviors as well. It was very, very quickly contagious. Everyone starts to use the phone. So in our reporting, which Paige Tutt, one of our editors, did from three schools on the relative effectiveness of cell phone policies, most teachers and most principals were saying all along that cell phones were being used to provoke fights, that kids were talking to other kids and making jokes in the same classroom, that they were filming teachers as they were teaching and making jokes about them. And so, you know, you had this unraveling of the culture. And at the same time, you had this terrible impact on attention and focus inside classrooms. You know, they probably never should have been in classrooms or schools. And I'm generally glad to see they're on the way out. So we're starting to see the tide turn a little bit. And this study from India really gives us more reason to make sure that we get phones out of classrooms.
Okay, let's talk about the results from the study in India. Yuki, what did the researchers conclude?
What the researchers found was that in classrooms where cell phones were banned, you actually saw student achievement improve, which is a really good deal to see that impact from banning phones.
It wasn't the only study either. So Yuki pointed out this was a great study. It was a really, really clean study. A Florida study actually released a few months later found something similar, ultimately, that when cell phones were banned, you saw a distinct rise in academic achievement and a reduction in unexcused absences.
Yuki, did the researchers in India find any downsides to banning phones in schools?
Right. So it wasn't just the India study, but both the India study and the Florida study. And what they found was that there was an adjustment period where you had kids who had more discipline issues when the cell phone bans were implemented. And what that suggests is that there will be a period of transition where you're trying to get kids on board.
But it's not a panacea. You remove a phone and kids may go back to more traditional forms of misbehavior, right? So you're going to see kids potentially in this interim period, you may see some increase in disciplinary issues. But what the study in India really, really makes clear is it's not just that there were academic benefits. It's also that, for example, kids were talking less about material that was unrelated to academics. Students and teachers were getting along better. It looked like the classrooms were much more conducive to learning.
Now, Steve, I want to ask you what the research tells us. We have a question from a teacher in our community.
Yeah.
Kevin asks, I'm curious to know what level of cell phone restriction works best. Total bans during the school day, classroom bans. Steve, what does the research say?
Yeah, I think the research is pretty clearly in favor of top-down policies that are uniformly and globally enforced. It should be a school-wide policy. It should be enforced very, very consistently. All the teachers should be on board, and the principals and the superintendents need to be on board as well. We also saw a survey this year in which teachers reported that the more restrictive the cell phone policy, the fewer cell phone interruptions they had in their classrooms. So it may sound a little strange, but keeping cell phones out of hallways and cafeterias may also make them less of a problem in classrooms. And that would argue pretty strongly for the effectiveness of school-wide bans as opposed to more narrow bans.
Okay. Before we play the lightning round, let's take a look at one more study. This one examined the relationship between playtime and chronic stress in kids. The researchers studied fourth graders at recess. Before we get to what they found, Yuki, let's talk about the known benefits of recess.
It's a form of exercise. It's a form of physical activity. There's lots of science that shows that exercise is beneficial because when you exercise, you're not just increasing blood flow to the brain that boosts learning, memory, and attention, but there are also long-term benefits like having fitter, more active bodies, which leads to better overall brain health. And when students are on the playground, they're also practicing social skills. So kids are learning how to take turns. They're learning how to manage conflict. And when they come back into the classroom after taking a recess break, kids are fresher. They're more attentive to a lesson. And we see lots of actual concrete academic benefits of recess where kids are just primed to learn.
Steve, What can you tell us about what researchers found about how recess affects stress?
What the researchers found here is, and they were looking, they did, it's kind of a novel study. They were looking at the chronic stress issue. Not all stress is bad. Sometimes you want to have stress. It certainly focuses you. And so stress can be beneficial. But too much of it, chronic stress, that's not so good. They took two groups of kids, one group from kind of more traditional schools where they were having a 30-minute recess every day, fourth graders having 30 minutes of recess. And then they compared it with another group of schools who've been doing 45 minutes of recess for the academic year. What they found is that the kids who had experienced 45 minutes of recess on a daily basis had 68% less cortisol in their hair strands. That's a hormone that takes a while to gather in hair. And so it's kind of more of an indicator of chronic stress.
So am I understanding correctly that the absence of recess actually raises stress levels in kids? Why is that?
Yeah, I wouldn't say the absence of recess raises stress levels. What I would say is that when kids are routinely experiencing only 30 minutes of recess versus kids who are routinely experiencing 45 minutes or an hour of recess, the amount of stress that they retain physically is higher. So what does that mean? According to the researchers, 30 minutes of recess is not enough time for fourth graders. You need 45 minutes or an hour of recess to make sure that kids are kind of like working at a baseline of well-being and happiness that they should have at that age level. And I also think we should start thinking about recess in the middle school and high school levels as well.
Ah, you predicted my next question, Steve. I was going to ask you if you did find any research that looked at the benefits of unstructured playtime for older kids.
I haven't seen it. Yuki may have something here about unstructured play or playtime for older kids. I can say that there's plenty of evidence that after school activities are usually regarded very highly by adolescents. And there's lots of evidence. We saw some surveys from back during the COVID period where what kids missed the most was engagement with peers after school in particular, in the types of clubs and the types of activities that they really enjoyed with the kids. There's lots of evidence that breaks are crucial. They're going to come back to the classroom more refreshed, more focused. And so there is evidence that recess would work at that level, but it tends to be tangential. It's things that we can draw an inference from as opposed to research that's directly experimentally related to those conditions.
Before we wrap up, let's talk about how recess has changed in recent decades. Do we know how long recess typically is today? Is there any data on this?
Yeah, there's data on it. According to both the CDC and a very recent survey from EdWeek, most elementary school kids are getting somewhere between 20 and 30 minutes of recess a day. That's less than what these researchers are saying kids should have. So look, I know that academic work needs to be done. I'm not suggesting at all that we don't continue to do hard academic work, but the pendulum has probably swung too far towards more seat time. And we might want to listen to researchers who are arguing for more play time.
That sound means it's time for our lightning round. We're going to put you both in the hot seat here. The idea is to cover three education studies in 3 minutes. Here's how it's going to work. I'm going to ask you to tell me one key finding for each study, and then I'm going to ask you to give me one tip for using this research in school. Are you ready, Yuki and Steve?
Ready.
I'm 100% ready.
Okay. Our first study explores the connections between handwriting and early literacy. What's the big takeaway here?
These were 5-year-old kids. So these were kids who were just learning how to read. Kids who practiced handwriting versus kids who typed had better literacy skills. They were better able to identify and name words and also write words and also identify and name letters. What this study revealed was that handwriting itself it's actually a key component of learning how to read, of learning how to identify letters and words.
Okay, time's up, Yuki. Tell us, how can lower elementary school teachers use this research in the classroom?
Well, the big takeaway here is that typing cannot replace handwriting. Like, you have to work on handwriting skills with kids because it's not just about writing letters. It's about getting kids to slow down and process the information and actually do the physical manipulations of writing out the letters. And that helps them understand the alphabetic and the orthographic dimensions of literacy.
Okay, Steve, I'm throwing this one to you. We are making a big turn from writing with pen and paper to writing with AI. MIT researchers wired college-age students up to an EEG machine as they wrote essays and gave some of them ChatGPT access. Tell us what they learned.
Well, the college-aged adults who used ChatGPT couldn't remember really anything that they'd just written. So when they were asked to recall a sentence from the essay they just submitted, they couldn't recall a single sentence.
Steve, what are the implications for ELA classes?
Well, I think it's not just ELA. So there was another study the year before that we looked at that suggested that the same occurred when high school-aged math students used ChatGPT. They basically just asked for the answer and didn't remember anything they learned either. So the insight here is, if you're learning a foundational skill, consider keeping AI out of the picture entirely.
Last one, Yuki. We have another study on AI, but this one looked at how special ed teachers are using AI to draft IEPs, or individual education programs. What did the researchers find?
Right, so for this study, I spoke to the lead researcher, Danielle Waterfield, and what she found was that when you had experienced special education teachers both write IEP goals on their own and use ChatGPT to assist them in writing those goals, the quality of the goals was the same. So the big insight for her was that by using ChatGPT, you can have the same level of quality, and that frees up special education teachers to have more face-to-face time with the students they're working with.
And we should note here that the lead author, Danielle Waterfield, is a former special ed teacher herself. Did she have any tips for using AI effectively to write IEPs?
So it's not just asking ChatGPT to write an IEP goal. It's understanding that there are pieces of information that you can feed ChatGPT. So you want to feed it the actual overall IEP goal. And what it'll do is it'll help you construct the goals for the student.
Yuki and Steve, excellent work. I say A+.
If you say so.
No extra credit for you, Steve, with that attitude. This was such a great conversation. Thank you so much for joining me today on the show.
Oh, no problem at all. That was a blast.
Yeah, thank you. This is so fun.
Stephen Merrill is Edutopia's editor-in-chief, and Yuki Terada is our research editor. We didn't have time to cover all 10 research topics in this episode, but you can read Steve and Yuki's article on our website. It's called The 10 Most Significant Education Studies of 2025. And stay tuned for more research right here in your podcast feed. We've got some new research episodes coming your way next year that we think you're going to love. Keep an ear out for that in 2026. Follow us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please leave us a rating and a review. This episode was produced by Ann Noisani and edited by me. Our engineer is Doug Keeley, and our supervising editors are Sarah Gonser and Stephen Merrill. I'm Kristen Leong. We'll see you again in the new year.